Hi, and welcome to the MVP Virtual Conference. My name is Dave Birmingham. I'm going to be talking about deploying highly available SQL Server in Microsoft Infrastructure as a Service. I'll get that out. And here to help me is my good friend and colleague, Denny Cherry. Denny's been a SQL MVP since 2008, and he's the owner, founder, and principal consultant for Denny Cherry and Associates. Danny and I have done some work together over the past 6 months or so with customers deploying high availability in Windows Azure, so he's the perfect person to answer your questions. He'll be online throughout the entire session fielding your questions, and I'll have him join in at the end where we can discuss some of the things we've seen in the field as well as answer any more common questions that we have. Again, my name is Dave Birmingham. I'm a cluster MVP since 2010, as well as a senior technical evangelist for Silas Technology. So my focus really is on high availability and lately in the Azure space. So quick overview of the agenda. So why high availability? We're going to talk about downtime in the cloud. Platform as a service, infrastructure service, differences and what we're going to be talking about tonight, and then the components of Azure High Availability. We're going to take a deeper look at each of the components here, from starting at your virtual network, which is the backbone of your Azure deployment. We're going to go and describe fault domains, update domains, failover clustering, and then really the two options for high availability in the cloud: the always-on availability group and the SQL always-on failover cluster instances. And then finally, how the internal load balancer, the Azure internal load balancer, comes into play in this configuration. It's key to making this whole configuration work. So as I mentioned, submit your questions on the Q&A tab, and Denny is going to be answering them. If the time permits, we will take some questions at the end and have a kind of open forum discussion. I will take all the questions we receive and create a FAQ format in my blog, Clustering for Mere Mortals, and I will post that just as soon as possible. Code examples that I will have tonight will also be available in my blog. I know it says here they're available now, but give me just a few hours afterwards, and I'll put them up tonight on my clusteringformeremortals.com blog. So first, why high availability? It's a quote from Josh Whitaker that the average unavailability of cloud services is 10 hours per year or more, 99.9% availability. That's over 9 hours of downtime per year, which is generally far less than expected for business-critical applications. And if we look at a little bit closer, that number is not far off, and in many cases is actually kind of conservative. This is a list of the 10 biggest cloud outages as reported by CRN, this article referenced at the end here. But you can see, just because you're deploying in the cloud does not mean that you can just forget about availability. You need to plan in your cloud implementation for the inevitable downtime that's going to happen. So we talk about Azure and we talk about SQL. There's really two ways to go. There's SQL Platform as a Service, or PaaS, or Infrastructure as a Service. Now, the SQL Server Windows Azure Virtual Machine Infrastructure as a Service is really much like your standard implementations. They give you the platform to deploy virtual machines, and you have full access to those virtual machines. You can add storage. You can add SQL and control it very much like your on-premise infrastructure. The Windows Azure SQL database is their platform as a service, and really this is a fully managed relational database service. And this is really what Azure was started out as. They had this SQL platform as a service, so you could build to the SQL platform as a service and just let Microsoft worry about managing the infrastructure itself, a SQL Server, making sure a SQL Server is highly available, and you don't have to worry about it. There's some definite restrictions if you go that route. So you're going to want to look into that to make sure you're making the right choice. But for this demonstration or this talk, we're going to be really focusing in on the Windows Infrastructure as a Service, where you're going to be deploying SQL Server yourself and managing it. And so you need to build the high availability into your deployment. So the first part of the high availability components is the virtual network. And again, this is the backbone of everything you're going to do in Azure. Here's a bullet list of what is on the Azure website of what the virtual network is. The important thing that you need to know about the virtual network is that it really is required for high availability for a few reasons. One is that you have to you need a virtual network if you're going to have things like fault domains and update domains, which we're going to get to in a moment. But also, you need the virtual network if you're going to consider deploying any sort of hybrid cloud environment. In the talk today, for people within an hour, I kind of focus on high availability within the Azure cloud. We're not going to stretch into hybrid cloud configurations where you talk about disaster recovery, of maybe going from on-prem into the Azure cloud for disaster recovery, or even from the Azure cloud back to on-premise for additional protection. But we're going to focus in on just high availability within the Azure cloud. But keep in mind, if you're doing any sort of hybrid cloud, the virtual network is going to be, which is going to be used to bridge those networks. So when we talk about Azure and high availability, the first thing we need to look at is something called fault domain. And that's an Azure term that essentially, if you read the documentation, you'll see people reference it as a rack of servers. It really is a fault domain is a area in Azure that is totally independent of another fault domain. So it's different hardware, different networking, different power, so that you eliminate any single point of failure, assuming you have two instances, two virtual machines running in different fault domains. You can be relatively sure that some sort of unexpected failure in Azure is not going to bring down both of those instances at the same time. And for that reason, a fault domain is actually a requirement in order to qualify for the 99.95% uptime service level agreement that you can get within Azure. So to qualify for that service level agreement, you have to have two fault domains and an instance in each fault domain. If you've done that, you guarantee that you will have, I say, dial tone to at least one of those instances at any given time. What that does not guarantee, though, is that if we're in the instance of SQL Server, it does not guarantee that SQL Server will be up and running. So that's what we're going to focus on. We're going to talk about how you can take advantage of fault domains in the SQL Server environment. For things like web servers and application servers that can be load balanced, simply putting up two fault domains and two instances in each, an instance in each fault domain can give you a level of high availability, but for SQL Server needs a little bit more configuration. By default, and we're going to look at this, when you provision a virtual machine, there's a setting called an availability set. And by putting your virtual machines in the same availability set, you can assure that those virtual machines will be distributed across different fault domains. By default, Azure gives for each availability set two fault domains. And we're going to talk about why that's good, but also why that in some cases is not actually going to be good enough. And there's a new feature that's just been released that we can talk about that will enable you to actually force Azure to give you three fault domains, which you're going to want to have in any particular cluster configuration. And that's referenced here in this last bullet. using Azure Resource Manager. Just stumbled across this article. It was posted at the beginning of May, and I tried to look at it today. It actually, the link was broken, so I'm sure it's going to come back up. But by using the template in this link, that you are able to actually deploy an availability set that has three fault domains. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to demonstrate that. Again, just kind of discovered it, but I wanted to include it here because it is going to be very important in your configuration. So fault domains, the other thing we have is the upgrade domains or update domains, which actually minimizes the planned downtime for maintenance. So in Windows Azure, Microsoft's going to have to do maintenance. At some point in time, they're going to have to reboot servers, and some of that maintenance is actually going to cause the virtual machines running in Azure to go offline. And unfortunately, that Azure maintenance most likely is going to occur without a warning. And so in order to protect against planned downtime, they have something called the update domains. And again, by putting your virtual machines in the same availability set, you're going to ensure that each virtual machine will run in its own update domain. And by default, Microsoft gives you 5 update domains. So the update domains will help protect against planned downtime. Now, there's no published number of how often planned maintenance is going to occur. I've done kind of a very unscientific poll of some of my customers, and it seems like maybe every other month that there will be an instance where a virtual machine was shut down. And so, you know, just keep that in mind that the update domains are going to be important to ensure you have availability even during the planned maintenance period. So I have a quick demonstration where we're going to actually provision a virtual machine. I'm going to show you the availability sets. It's important to set a static IP address on your virtual machine. The Azure Resource Manager template, that's that link I was referenced earlier. I probably won't actually look at that just for the sake of time. But that you're going to want to look at on your own so that you can actually create a resource group that has three fault domains. And I'm going to show you a quick PowerShell demonstration of how you can actually see how many update domains you have and how many fault domains you have and which virtual machines are running in each. So let me jump out. I actually recorded these demos for the sake of demo guides and time. If there's anything in the cloud, especially this This is the Azure portal we're looking at here. This is a preview portal, and many of the features that are in a preview portal are not available in the older portal. The preview portal is great, but it's still in preview, so things are changing, and sometimes you run into some bugs, and things are a little bit slow sometimes. So, again, I just wanted to record it. So what I'm going to show you here is creating a virtual machine. So we started by clicking on this new button, and we're going to go to Compute, and we're going to choose to create a Windows Server 2012. And here are some of the options you have. You're going to give it a host name, so you're going to give the computer a name. You're going to fill in the username and password. And the pricing tier, there's all different sizes of virtual machines you can choose from. So, you know, the more power, the more money. So for demo purposes, you keep the instances small. But, you know, in production, you're probably going to want to pick a larger instance that's going to support your particular workload. So after you pick your size, there's optional network configurations. And we're going to we'll look at the location first. So one thing that I did before I created the virtual machine, which I didn't show you, is I actually created my virtual network. Again, for sake of time, the virtual network is already created, and I put it in the U.S., East U.S. 2. So that's what we're going to choose now. We're going to pick the East U.S. 2, and that will allow me to go in and under the under the optional configurations here, we'll be able to pick the availability sets that I've already created here. So let's see. Right, so first thing we're going to do is choose an availability set. Actually, I think in my demo here, I created a new availability set. So you have an option of creating a new availability set or and give it a name, and then when you come in and create your second virtual machine, you're going to put that virtual machine in the same availability set. Again, this is the key component that I mentioned, that you must create these availability sets and put your virtual machines in that availability set in order to qualify for the service level agreement. And here I'm going to choose the virtual network I created earlier. Clicking here, you'll see all the virtual networks that are in the US East 2 environment are shown as this virtual network I created, Azure East. And then finally, I think I'm going to choose a virtual IP address. So by default, Azure Virtual Machines uses DHCP. You're going to want to actually create a static private IP address. So that's what I'm doing here. And once you've done that, the virtual machine will provision, and you'll be good to go. I'm going to show you, as soon as this finishes, you probably want to get very familiar with PowerShell. The GUI is fine and dandy, but if you're doing work in Azure on any regular basis, PowerShell is going to make things much faster, much more predictable, easier to recreate. So I think I jump here into a PowerShell demo. This is basically the code. Pause it here for a second. I define all the variables up front. So I'm creating an availability set called availability set demo. I chose an instance size of small, my virtual machine name, demo one. I have my administrator name, a password, the primary subnet. This is a subnet name I defined when I created my virtual network, along with the primary IP. This is static IP I want to assign. And then the cloud service name, SQL failover, virtual network, again, that's what we picked earlier. The image name, this is the most, this is the image, this is the Windows Server 2012 image from April of 2015. This is updated about monthly, so you want to make sure you get the latest image for your instance. And once you've done that, here's the code. Again, I'll post this on my blog for you to look at, but it's pretty common knowledge. The one important thing here, again, is set Azure static VNet IP. You definitely want your virtual machines having a static IP, and especially your domain controllers. So that's, again, that's another way. That's the way I generally work. I'm provisioning my virtual machines through PowerShell. Again, it's much faster. You run that, and your virtual machines create it. And you can create multiple virtual machines at a time. All right. So let's jump back here. Oh, okay, this is the last demo I want to show you. This code right here, look at Git Azure Service. Git Azure VM, select instance upgrade domain and instance fault domain. So if you want to actually have a look to see which servers are running in which upgrade domain and fault domain, by running this PowerShell command here, you see a list of the servers I have in that that service, the SQL failover service. And you can currently see the upgrade domains. There's four upgrade domains. The first three servers are in the same upgrade domain, and then SQL 2 is in its own, SQL 3 is in its own, VM1 is in its own, and you would have up to five by default. The default domains, you can see there's only two, 0 and 1. And so this is important for clustering, again, you want to have to make sure that if you lose one fault domain, you still have one cluster node up and running. And here, where it gets funny is, if you're familiar with clustering, and again, we'll touch on clustering, we'll touch on a lot of things and try to squeeze a lot into an hour. I really want to focus on what's unique about Azure. But in failover clustering, you're going to have a quorum that includes a file share witness in Azure. Preferably, each node and the file share witness would be in its own fault domain, so that the failure of any single fault domain would only impact one vote of your cluster at a time. And by default, you only get two fault domains. So you could actually wind up with your file share witness and a cluster node in the same fault domain. And if that fault domain goes offline, you actually not have a failover occur because you've lost two out of three votes in your cluster. That's, you know, so you won't have a majority of votes left and you will actually not come online. So getting three fault domains is going to be important in your configuration. Otherwise, you could put your vote in a totally different geographic region in Azure that ensures it's separate from everything else. Or if you're doing hybrid clustering back on-prem, once Windows Server 10 or 2016 or whatever's being called, once that's released, failover clustering is going to have this new cloud witness, which is going to take the place of a file share witness and allow you to actually use just some basic Azure cloud storage and let that be available. So that's coming soon. Let's jump back into the slides here. All right. So we talked about update domains, default domains. So any high availability, whether we're talking about SQL Server always-on availability groups or SQL Server failover cluster instance, is all built upon Windows Server failover clustering as its base component. And again, we're going to just kind of touch on clustering. There's a lot of information on the web. I really want to focus on how it's different in Azure because it is slightly different. There are some what I would call workarounds due to some Azure networking issues that we'll talk about here. But essentially, to create a failover cluster, you're going to enable the failover clustering feature. You're going to run the cluster validation wizard, and you'll see that you'll actually get some warnings. They'll warn you about storage, and they'll warn you about network, and we're going to look at the validation report. The important thing is you will see that we have to fix the cluster IP address because this is one of the kind of kinks in Azure is that.
Sorry about the technical difficulties here. I'm going to pick up where I left off so we can get through the presentation here. What I was showing on the screen here is the cluster creation process. Once again, cluster IP conflict will cause all sorts of problems. Again, this is one symptom. You may see other symptoms. You may see some weird message that the cluster failed to create. Don't get nervous. Just go to the backup cluster node and open up Failover Cluster Manager, and you should be able to connect to the cluster from one of the nodes. And so the node that you can connect to, you need to go into this IP resource in the cluster core resources and change the static IP address, set a static IP address, set it to something that's not in use on your network. And that will take care of the first problem of needing of Azure handing out a duplicate IP. All right, so let's jump back into the slides here. Okay, so now we have the core failover cluster created. Now we can look at SQL Server always-on availability groups. I can't see the screen. Okay, so not quite sure why you guys can't see my screen at this point. So let me look at what I was saying here. Oh, you can see now. Okay. I'm just going to jump back in. Okay, so the always-on availability groups, again, not kind of focus in on the Azure aspect of it. It works the same way in Azure as it does on-premise. Always-on availability groups was introduced in SQL Server 2012. Enterprise Edition is available in SQL 2014. You can have up to 4 replicas with SQL Server 2012, up to 8 replicas with SQL 2014, meaning you can have that many different copies of your database. You can have read-only replicas so that you can do reporting from one of the copies of the database. You can have up to two replicas in a failover configuration. So that will support automatic failover, and that's what you want. That's really what defines high availability, is that automatic failover and the client redirection piece. So you're going to be able to fail over between two fault domains using the always-on availability group. Synchronous replication is required for that automatic failover, and you can do asynchronous replication for replication further distances across VPNs and so forth. Again, it requires Enterprise Edition, and one of the limitations we're going to get to is that failover clustering can only support one client listener, and we'll talk about why that is in a little bit. So that is a limit that's specific to Azure. Now, normally you could configure many, many different client listeners, each associated with a different availability group. In Azure, however, you are limited to one, and that's because of the internal load balancer, which is required. Again, we'll talk about that at the very end of the presentation. The internal load balancer is required for the client redirection, and you can only have one internal load balancer per cluster. So I think, I'm going to skip the always-on demonstration. Creating an availability group, again, it's nothing. I wouldn't be able to show you anything different in Azure that you probably haven't seen on-premise or is not blogged about a million different times from the various SQL Server experts. It's a very simple wizard to walk through to create an availability group. So for sake of time, we'll skip that demo. And we'll go on to SQL Server Failover Cluster Instance. So SQL Server Failover Cluster Instance is really a fancy name for what's always been known as, it used to be MSCS, Microsoft Cluster Service, or now Windows Server Failover Clustering. It's a tried and true SQL Failover Cluster. And it protects the entire SQL Server instance. So the difference, again, availability groups is focused on user-defined databases, so it's a database-by-database replication. Failover cluster instances protects the entire SQL instance, so all the system tables, all your logins, all your agents, all your agent jobs are all part of the protection scheme. Again, it does require third-party replication solutions, because in Azure, typically a failover cluster instance would need shared storage. In Azure, there is no shared storage, so you're going to have to look into any certified replication solution like Sios DataKeeper for the replication piece. It will support automatic failover between two or more nodes, depending upon the replication solution. Synchronous or asynchronous replication is possible. And this is really supported way back in all flavors of SQL. So the currently supported versions, SQL 2008 through 2014. Standard Edition, it will support a two-node cluster. Enterprise Edition will support two or more nodes. So you can deploy Standard Edition and still have high availability. So let's take a look at this demonstration. Again, jump to the video here. This is a live demonstration. This is a failover cluster, And it, again, it looks like any other failover cluster that's on-premise. You have SQL Server storage. Again, you're going to use a data keeper volume instead of a shared disk. That has the name and the IP and the services. And, you know, you manage this like a regular cluster. You want to move this to a different node. You can do that through Failover Cluster Manager. And it behaves, again, just like a regular on-premise cluster. The secret to making this work in Azure, again, all comes down to the client access point. So whether you are deploying an always-on availability group or a always-on failover cluster instance, the name and the IP address, now normally at this point I'd be done with my configuration. I would just tell my clients to connect to this name, this cluster name called SQL Cluster, and that will resolve in DNS to this cluster IP address, 10.0.0.201, and everything would be fine and dandy. What happens if you try that in Azure, you'll find out very quickly that your clients cannot connect. It seems to fail over fine, you know, all the lights come on and it looks like it failed over and you're kind of scratching your head like, why can't I connect to my cluster? The issue is that what I've been told is Azure does not support gratuitous ARPs, so the IP address does not get propagated out to all the different switches and routers to redirect your clients to that. So your clients in Azure actually need to connect to an internal load balancer, which in turn then will redirect the traffic to whichever node is active in the cluster. And so that's what we're going to talk about next here. So the internal load balancer, it's what we're going to use for client redirection. Clients must connect to the internal load balancer. Now, the issue I mentioned earlier, there's only one, you can only deploy one internal load balancer per cluster. And, you know, because it's grouped in something called a cloud service, and each cloud service can only have one internal load balancer. So you are limited to just one client access point per cluster. Here's the demonstration. Again, this is kind of the end of the presentation. This is the most important part of the entire presentation here. So we're going to create the internal load balancer. We're going to then fix the cluster IP resource, which is the second part of the configuration we'll talk about. And then we're going to open it up to some questions here before the end. Let's roll the last video. Okay, so this is some PowerShell. I mentioned Azure PowerShell. If you don't have it, you have to download it and configure it to connect to your Azure subscription. I've already done all of that. And this particular script is something I use to create the internal load balancer and to add the load balanced endpoints. So again, I define all the variables up front. We'll look at a few of these. The IP. This IP address that you see, the .201, that has to match the IP address that your SQL cluster client access point uses. The service name, again, that's the service name of that all your nodes reside in. Your first virtual machine, SQL 1, the endpoint name, you make up whatever you want, EP1. The second virtual machine, again, these are the actual virtual machines in my cluster, SQL 1 and SQL 2, endpoint name 2, load balance name, you can call it whatever you want. Now, this is the bare minimum that you would ever want to configure in terms of the ports that you're going to redirect. We're going to redirect the 1433 port and assign load endpoints just for that port. You may need to add additional ports if you want to support SQL Browser, or you want to do any sort of file shares or anything like that. So whatever additional ports are required for your particular application, you would just add more endpoints. And the second two lines would add for the additional endpoints. But this is the bare minimum just for SQL Server to start talking and get accepting traffic. All right, so once you have that script created the way you want it, you're going to go ahead and run that script, and it will create the internal load balancer, as well as add those two endpoints to each virtual machine so that the traffic can be redirected to it. Now, this will take a little bit of time. Through the magic of videos, I can speed things up. And yeah, so this is what you should see at the end is this load balancer being created. And the second part, so now you've created the internal load balancer, you've added the endpoints. Now there's one other piece of magic that you must do before you can actually communicate with this cluster. And it's this, let's jump forward to it here, is there's a PowerShell script that you need to actually run on one of the cluster nodes. And it's going to, you can't see it all here, but again, I'll post this on my blog at the end. But essentially, it's going to allow the cluster node to receive the connection from the client access point. And it's also going to create a subnet mask of 255.255.255.255. So it's a client, it's a host specific subnet mask so that you don't have IP address conflicts between the internal load balancer and the cluster IP address that you're going to use. So you run that command, and it says, again, once you run it, you see the warning here that you have to restart the SQL IP address in order for it to take effect. So you'll go ahead and open a filler cluster manager, take the virtual IP address offline, and bring it back online. And then at that point, your clients will be able to connect to SQL Server. So we got about 15 minutes. Let me look at the, so this is the end of the presentation. So we're going to, I'm going to ask Denny to jump in here. And if there's any recurring questions or even some tips from the field, you know, Denny has implemented quite a few of these over the past few months. And so, you know, he might have some good insight that I wasn't able to get to in the presentation. So, Denny, are you on the line?
I am, Dave. Can you hear me okay?
All right. Danny, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah,
I hear you.
Excellent. So the big question we've had is, what's the best way to set up a cluster? Is it to start with a single-node cluster or start with a two-node cluster and set it up that way?
Yeah, I've done it both ways. I think if you set up a single-node cluster, you might have more predictable behavior. Now, if you saw my demonstration, it seems to happen different every time. There's a few different ways that cluster will behave because of that IP address conflict. If you set up a single node at a time, you probably get a more predictable behavior because again, depending upon how you know the cluster, what IP address it grabs, you're going to get some strange behavior and that's to be expected. So setting a single node, you know, might be able to give you a little bit more predictable results.
Okay, and that matches with our single node as well. So the one I mean, some questions here. So, some of the things I've seen in the field is that internal load balancer really cranky sometimes. Do you have any best practices for people, any advice for people on how to configure that to keep that crankiness to a minimum?
There are some other parameters which I didn't delve into that will allow you to control how, you know, the failover time. So essentially, whenever a failover occurs, there's a timeout period where the backup server will still, you know, could potentially, the load balancer could potentially send traffic to it. And by tuning some of the parameters, and Denny, you may have know the parameter names off the top of your head, but by tuning some of the parameters, which essentially is a parameter that says, you know, how often do you send a probe and how many probes can you miss before you remove one of the endpoints from the load balance set. If you could tune those all the way down, you can make sure that your backup node is not accidentally being sent traffic while the SQL Server is not running. So that's definitely one thing to look at if you're having some problems with client reconnection.
Yeah, I believe that's set probe interval. I don't remember the other one. Set probe frequency or something like that.
Yeah, I'll put some more information about that on the blog after the presentation here. I have something. I mean, I created one endpoint for the standard SQL port. I mentioned you might want to add a port for SQL browser. I ran into a customer who had a SQL database and was trying to configure System Center to use that database. And there were more ports that System Center wanted. And again, there were some ports, some NetBIOS ports that I was looking for. And sometimes you might have to actually dig in and get your network monitor to see what traffic is being passed and what ports are really required, and you're going to have to add those additional endpoints depending upon your application needs. And this can be, you know, we demonstrated a SQL Server cluster, but you could build a file server cluster. Again, you know, that would require the Cyrus DataKeeper software. But there was just a article published this week on Microsoft talking about highly available SAP in Azure. And so it's a great white paper. And one of the components that needs to be highly available is this file share resource. So they talk about there's some really good code examples in there as well, and even some more best practices. So that's I'll link to that in my article as well as for some additional reading that you probably want to take a look at for some more best practices.
Yeah, so that parameter is probe interval in seconds.
There you go.
Remember that I blogged about it a while back.
Yeah. So, you know, I will be online, and if you have any more questions, definitely on Twitter. And Denny, sorry, I should have put your Twitter up here, but I think you're at Mr. Denny, is that right?
That is correct.
That's correct.
Yeah, so you can tweet Denny Cherry, who knows anything and everything there is to know about SQL Server, and is probably really one of two people that I know who knows this Azure high availability stuff inside and out, because it's really kind of a new frontier. It wasn't only this past August where Microsoft added support for any kind of clustering in Azure, so it's very very new. But Denny definitely has a, you know, a lot of experience implementing it. My blog, Clustering for Mere Mortals, I mentioned I'll post all the code examples and you know, some good information on there. And of course, if you have any questions, just shoot me an email. And I'd be glad to get on the phone with you and give you a hand. Unless there's anything else you want to add, I think we'll just wrap it up here. Apologies for the audio issues, but I hope you were able to catch enough. And if you have any questions, definitely feel free to hit me up. All right. Well, thanks once again.